Hello and welcome to Volume 86 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about how improving access to your forest land can result in better stumpage prices. We'll talk about what to expect from the Alabama legislature now that it's in session. We'll learn about what private land contributes to the GDP versus what public land contributes. And we'll hear more about why the Alabama Farmers Federation wants to change the popular Forever Wild program. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Beginning in the late 19th century, the trend has been to increase the amount of public land in the United States. Most people instinctively appreciate that fact. But there is a cost to the economy when land leaves private hands and becomes public. Dave Tenney with the National Alliance of Forest Owners has quantified the cost of public land, and he's our first guest on Capital Ideas Live. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
What is the story that your study tells us about the contributions that private land makes versus public?
Well, first of all, let me point everybody to where they can look at this if they want to see it, www.nafoalliance.org. It's right on the front page of our website, so if you want to look at this, that's where you find it. The study that we've done in conjunction with Forest to Market is an effort to quantify the contributions that these our private forests make in 29 states that are most heavily forested in the United States. And the objective here is to put information in the hands of forest owners so that when they're talking about their contributions to a policymaker in Washington, D.C., or a policymaker in their hometown, they can tell them exactly what they're contributing in a way that they've never been able to do before.
And I was going to say, is there a human element then to this contribution? What is the flesh and blood takeaway from it?
Flesh and blood takeaway is that it's one thing to walk into the office of someone that you're trying to persuade and say, you know, I make a really big contribution. It's another thing to walk into someone's office and say, you know, my forest in your state are employing 6 people for every 1,000 acres, or my forest in your state are contributing $241 per acre to the gross domestic product. That tells a very powerful message to whomever you're talking to. You're informed. Your information matters. It speaks to issues that are of great concern to policymakers today, the economy, jobs. Yeah.
Put yourself in the position of just an average forest owner, not someone such as yourself who regularly deals with influential people in Washington, but someone who has forest land and wants to use this information. How do you think they can get the most out of it?
I think that they can do is they can walk into a door and be informed about what's going on statewide. Just having those numbers to tell the story, 3% of the over 3% of the gross domestic product in the entire state comes from our private forest. But here's what it means to me. When I walk out on my land and I'm working with my land, I'm thinking in my mind how many people's lives are affected by the fact that I'm owning and managing this land. What this tool does is on a per acre basis gives that landowner the ability to quantify that for the person they're talking to. I'm affecting this many lives because of the management that I'm doing on this land, and that's why it matters to the local community here, the economy, the families who are working and who rely on this source of energy and income and contribution to the economy.
Okay. We've got a little bit of time left. What do you see are the couple of issues that Congress is going to face that Alabama forest owners should be concerned about?
Energy and climate change. They're changing. Energy is continuing to be a very important topic in Washington, D.C., and in the state, I'm sure, and that's going to continue. Climate change is going to shift. As Congress is unable to work on it, the EPA will. And our vigilance will focus on, and it needs to be collective vigilance, to focus on how EPA is going to treat private forests in any kind of climate regulation that they might undertake.
All right. Thank you, Dave. We appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
The Alabama Forest Federation has never been one to shy away from controversy. It recently had the courage to suggest changes in the popular Forever Wild program that uses oil and gas revenues to convert private land to public land. We have Jeff Helms with us to explain the change that the group is proposing. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. How are you doing?
The Alabama Farmers Federation supported the creation of Forever Wild program. Why have you changed it?
Well, we originally recognized the concept of preserving environmentally sensitive and historically unique lands as being something that our members were supportive of doing 20 years ago. As we've watched the Forever Wild program grow now to over 200,000 acres of state-owned land, we have noticed that there has been more of a tendency for that group to purchase land that is not necessarily environmentally sensitive. Some productive farmland has been purchased. In addition to that, there is a concern about some other needs that exist out there for conservation, and so our organization's leaders have asked that we pursue looking into some of those other options when this comes up for reauthorization. It's due for reauthorization. If not this legislative session, it would have to be reauthorized in the 2011 legislative session. And so rather than letting that automatically happen, we want to have a conversation about the best use of these funds.
Tell us exactly how you'd propose changing the allocation of that money.
Well, the conservation programs that are currently administered through Alabama Soil and Water Conservation Districts for landowners in all 67 counties have historically been underfunded. And so one of the things that we're discussing is a program that would allow a third of the funding that is currently being used for Forever Wild to stay with that program to preserve what has been gained there and let that continue to operate, but then to use other funds, some of these other funds to support the conservation, soil and water conservation programs, as well as possibly using some of the funds for farmland preservation. 20 states throughout the country have farmland preservation programs. Alabama has one, but it's almost non-existent. I think just a few thousand acres have been able to be preserved through that program, and there's a extensive waiting list to preserve green space, particularly in rapidly developing urban areas.
What is the case that you would make to legislators and voters to say this money should be used for conservation and farmland preservation?
Well, first of all, as a number of the studies have pointed out, public land, the return on public land to the economy is substantially less than what it is to private land. So you look at programs like the conservation program and even farmland preservation. Both of those allow the land to stay in private ownership. You're simply providing cost share assistance for conservation programs in one case, and in the other case, purchasing development rights. So the land stays in the economic stream, number one. Number two, you get a lot of benefit in terms of environmental benefits through protecting our soil and water, and also in preserving green space in the urban areas. So I think that there is, benefits there. And the Forever Wild program, what people don't realize that, that land's purchased from someone too. So the idea that you're only benefiting a certain number of people, you could say that about Forever Wild. That land was purchased by an individual owner. So these programs at least benefit all the state. All 67 counties can participate. And so we think that is a strong argument for that. Plus, with 90% of the land in the state of Alabama privately held, if our ultimate goal as a state is to conserve natural resources and preserve some of this green space, it seems that it's not very feasible at some point just to accomplish that through the state buying land.
You're going to have to do it through private land anyway. So.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate that. Well, that uneasy feeling you get this time of year can be explained by the fact that the Alabama legislature has convened and is about the task of spending your money on things they think you need. We've invited Chris Isaacson, the Executive Vice President of the Alabama Forestry Association, to comment. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Ace.
What are your predictions this year for the legislative session?
Well, Hayes, this everything is happening now, and of course, legislature came in session last week. But everything that's being done now is being done against the backdrop of the November elections. Our state lawmakers are in a pretty tough position now when it comes to state budgets, which will be a big theme of the session. The governor's built his budgets around an infusion of an additional $1 billion from a second federal stimulus package that's pending in Congress. Whether that comes through or not is debatable, and so the lawmakers are skeptical. Without that second infusion, the Legislative Fiscal Office is projecting about a $600 million budget shortfall in the general fund, with similar type challenges in the Education Trust Fund. So this really puts the legislators in a very uncomfortable position, especially in election year, of either forcing agency heads to make tough decisions, that might include furloughs or layoffs, or raising revenue. And as distasteful as furloughs and layoffs are, going to the voters in November, having a tax increase vote on your record is even more distasteful. So I think that will likely reduce the discussions and the push toward any type of tax increases in this session. However, I think we all should be prepared that revenue enhancement will be a top priority in 2011, and that's certainly something that we in the forestry community need to keep a very close eye on.
Speaking of the forestry community, do you anticipate any bills that are going to impact forest owners?
Yes, there are. There are several. The Alabama Forestry Commission has introduced three bills related to arson, timber theft, and equipment theft, strengthening some of the laws that are there, and we're working with them to try to move those through. The commission's funding is part of that state budget issue. They're going to have a big shortfall in their budget, so we're working with them closely to try to see how they can pull that together. Senator Coleman out of Birmingham has introduced a green building bill, and the bill right now is we're working with a number of other interested groups to ensure that there's fair treatment for products that are produced out of Alabama's forest. There's a number of other more business related bills that are of interest that we're looking at in the area of unemployment compensation, and some tax related bills that would hit businesses. On another front, in addition to the legislature, we've got some things that are happening in with some of the agencies. ADEM, there's been a group of environmental activists that have filed a petition with EPA challenging ADEM's primacy in enforcing water-related programs, federal water-related programs, and they're asking EPA to take that back over. That could have a potentially big impact on Alabama and forest landowners. Also, the Lynch lawsuit, property tax lawsuit that's seeking to throw out current property tax system, which would result in over 1,000% increase in property taxes. That looks like it's likely going to go to trial probably in the spring, early to late spring.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris. Hope you'll keep us apprised of those things. Thank you very much. For estate tax lawyers, this year is the one we've been waiting on. Zero estate taxes on all estates. So why isn't everyone jumping for joy? Cass Brewer is an estate tax lawyer, so we thought we'd ask him. Hello, Cass.
Hello, Hayes. Thank
you. Has the estate tax really been repealed?
No, it hasn't been repealed. And although it's discussed in the popular press as though it's gone away, it's really just a one-year suspension. What that means is for individuals dying in 2010, there's no estate or generation skipping tax. The gift tax, by the way, is still in place for 2010. But then what happens in 2011, unless Congress acts to change the law, the tax is going to come back, and it's going to come back with a vengeance. There are going to be a higher effective rates due to the fact that the exemption, which for last year was at $3.5 million per person, is going to be reduced to only $1 million per person.
That's the exemption, the size of the estate that is free from tax.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then perhaps worse than that, the rate, which last year, again, was 45%, is going to increase to a maximum rate of 55% in 2011. So we really do have this odd situation where it's not a repeal, it's merely a suspension of the tax.
How do people operate in this environment?
Well, it is very difficult. What we are advising our clients, first of all, every person's situation is unique, and every individual should periodically review their wills and other estate planning documents just to make sure change in personal circumstances don't affect their documents. This is a great time to do that, obviously, given the change in the law. We do have posted to the website a client alert that gives a bit more detail on the circumstances where we recommend individuals go see their tax advisor and take a fresh look at their will and other estate planning documents. But in general, I can say that if you and your spouse have a net worth of over $2 million, and if you have children, and if you have so-called tax-motivated wills, in other words, your wills were drafted on the assumption that there was an estate tax in place, and it took advantage of the exemption, the $3.5 million that I mentioned before, you really do need to take a close look at your documents, because the language of your document may cause the provisions to be carried out in a way that are dependent on the estate tax when it's not there, and that could defeat your intent.
And don't forget, your life insurance also may add and contribute to that $2 million. Real quick, what are your predictions for what Congress is going to do?
Well, that's another tough question, I'll tell you. I wouldn't bet on permanent repeal. I don't think we're going to see the estate tax go away forever. But I also don't think we're going to go back to a $1 million exemption and a 55% rate. So my best guess is that we are going to have an exemption in the range of $3.5 to $5 million, and that the rate will remain at 45%. Although we love the idea of not having taxes on estates, this uncertainty really creates its own problems. So it is my hope that Congress will act and act soon to help out our clients. We'd love for them to increase the exemption, but what we need is certainty so that we can plan.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Cass. One of the most talked about articles in Forest Landowner magazine is the summary of costs for forestry practices in the South, things like planting, prescribed fire, and cruising. Becky Barlow is co-author of that article. Hello, Becky.
Hi, Hayes. How are you?
Just want to learn a little bit about how the data is collected. How long has this type data been collected?
Well, this actual publication has a long and interesting history. It was actually started in 1953, was the first time it was actually reported in the Forest Farmer magazine. And since 1982, it's been in fairly close form that it is today, and it's been actually reported every 2 years since 1982.
All right. How do you collect the information, and who provides the data?
We use a mail survey, and we actually send it out to almost 300 individuals. Those are could be forestry consultants, private forest industry firms, and public agencies across 14 states. It is a really pretty lengthy survey. We really appreciate, you know, folks taking the time to do this, because we couldn't do it without them.
Are these across the South, the values, or do you have it broken down by states?
It's actually across the South by region. We actually have it broken into the northern and southern coastal plain and then the Piedmont region. So it's actually a guide for prices within a given region and not for a particular state.
Okay. What are the trends that you're seeing? You said this has been being done since 1982, every other year. So what trends have you noticed?
Well, we have, especially in the most recent survey, we have seen, of course, price increases through time. Some interesting things we saw with the most current survey were, one, with site preparation before planting. We saw an increase in the number of acres that had a had multiple passes. In other words, they had more than one site prep treatment on a given area, even though it may have cost more than a single pass treatment, which I thought was interesting. And then also was really unique that we, for the first time, saw enough acres of longleaf pine seedlings planted to actually be reported. And we also saw an increase in the number of seedlings per acre.
Okay, increases. Okay, all right. Well, thank you, Becky. We appreciate that.
Thanks.
Well, we learned from an article in the Birmingham News that the University of Alabama in Birmingham has published a study of tree stand accidents related to hunting. AFOA sponsors a hunting lease liability program. So we called on the author, Dr. Gerald McGuinn, to see if he could summarize his findings. Welcome, Dr. McGuinn.
Thank you for having me.
Remind people who aren't hunters what tree stands are and how hunters get hurt using them.
Tree stands are basically elevated structures, normally, most commonly attached to a tree, as the name suggests, and hunters climb up into them and basically use that elevated platform as a superior location for hunting.
They're about how high off the ground are we talking about?
It depends. They can certainly be, as high as 10, 15, 20, even higher up in the air. There are a variety of different types of these stands, both commercial and homemade, and therein lies many of the problems. This is not to suggest that one couldn't make one themselves. That's very safe. There are many of the injuries that we see at the UAB Trauma Center that are from commercial tree stands. It's really about appropriate use.
What types of injuries are you seeing?
The most common injuries that we saw in our particular study were upper and lower extremity fractures, which are not insignificant injuries. One of the common problems that we have seen with these types of injuries is that if the individual does, in fact, injure themselves, particularly a lower extremity injury, they can't walk and get help. And so we've had a fair number of patients who were injured falling from tree stands but then laid on the ground for quite some time before they were able to get some aid.
Okay. Do you have any recommendations for hunters and landowners who lease hunting land to reduce tree stand-related accidents?
I can probably speak more to the hunter safety than the landowner, but in the research on tree stands, much of what we see, unfortunately, is the role of alcohol. Alcohol contributes to a fair number of these types of injuries, and with many types of injuries, the combination of alcohol driving, alcohol hunting, et cetera, really just isn't a very good idea. The other issue that comes up with tree stands is maintenance, making sure that the tree stand, whether it's commercial or something that the hunter has made themselves, is in appropriate condition. And I guess the final thing, many tree stands, in fact, most of them come with a safety harness. And in the injuries that we see, the safety harness was either not used or was used inappropriately. So I think those are three reasonable approaches that the hunter themselves could take.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dr. McGuinn. Appreciate your contribution. The eucalyptus tree is not commonly thought of in connection with Alabama forests, but in the future that might change. We've invited Dr. Michael Cunningham of ArborGen, which operates a seedling nursery in Selma, to comment on his pioneering work in developing freeze-tolerant varieties of eucalyptus. Hello, Dr. Cunningham.
Hello, Hayes. Thank you for the invitation.
Why is the eucalyptus tree such an important hardwood tree for the United States?
Well, to start out with, in Alabama, hardwoods are very widely used by many of our consumers. And in the South, 60 to 80 million tons of hardwood are consumed annually. Most of those hardwood resources are procured from natural stands, and as we all know, most of those or many of those are in low-lying areas that are accessible during, usually are not accessible during wet periods. Planted hardwoods or purpose-grown hardwoods have been used sparingly to date by forest landowners, most efforts being with sweet gum, sycamore, or cottonwood are the most common. But each of these have some shortcomings. Sycamore and cottonwood are restricted due to site conditions, and sweet gum, while it's broadly adaptable, has a fairly slow growth rate. Eucalyptus, on the other hand, is one of the fastest-growing tree species in the world. It's native to Australia primarily, but is planted in over 90 countries and represents 8% of all planted forests. A large percentage of the eucalyptus is planted in Brazil, and about 8.5 million acres are planted there. The trees are, you know, exceedingly fast-growing, producing over 20 green tons per acre per year on 5 to 7 year rotations. They grow well on upland sites, and their wood properties make them a premier species for pulp, paper, and energy.
Okay. Give us an idea of where ArborGen stands in the commercialization of a freeze-tolerant variety.
So there are generally two different types of eucalyptus that we're working with. There's naturally cold-tolerant eucalyptus that have some degree of tolerance. There's a couple of species that we are working with, and these trees can tolerate cold temperatures down to about 10 degrees with just a limited amount of dieback. They'll grow at 7 to 8 year rotations and 10 to 14 tons per acre per year. And within the state of Alabama, we've typically define that as an area just a little bit north of Lake Eufaula on the east side across to, say, Butler on the west. Then there's the biotech freeze-tolerant species, which has gotten quite a bit of publicity lately. And what we are doing there is taking Eucalyptus urograndis, which is the most commonly planted eucalyptus in Brazil, which is not naturally cold tolerant and would grow only in South Florida. And we have added a gene to that tree which induces the tree to produce naturally occurring proteins that are there which give it its freeze tolerance. That tree we're projecting will survive at temperatures down to 16 degrees. It will grow at rates comparable to those in Brazil, and right now we're saying that it will grow somewhere around the I-10 corridor or south of there, so the southern parts of Alabama.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. Appreciate that. In our markets chair is Bob Rummer with the United States Forest Service. We'll talk with him not about timber prices specifically, but about what changes you can make on your land to improve timber marketability in general. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, Hayes.
What would stumpage prices, why is it that they increase in wet weather?
The primary factor is that it ends up with a shortage of wood at facilities when there's some kind of extended period of wet weather. December, as you're all aware, is one of the wettest months that we've had on record in many places in Alabama. And during that time, wood deliveries were interrupted, and we saw delivered wood prices doubling or even tripling during the month of December. So that meant that there was a premium on forest tracts that were accessible to contractors that were working in the month of December.
What are some of the important factors to make good forest access available to your property?
Well, if you're a forest landowner and you're thinking that you might have a tract that could be a wet weather access tract, take a look at it and consider two things. One would be, are the woods conditions something that would be operable during wet weather? In coastal plain sites, that would mean sandier soils, well-drained areas. Maybe in the Piedmont area sites, it would be good rocky terrain where forest operations could be continued during wet weather. So if the work can happen in the woods, that's step one. Then the second factor to consider is the access system, the forest road that gets to your forested tract, something that can be used during wet weather. And generally, consideration there is, how far is it to the nearest all-weather road, like a paved county road or improved graveled surface? So those would be two considerations to look at your track, determine if it's a potential candidate for wet weather access.
Okay. What should you do to address an all-weather access track?
If you've got one of those possible sites, the first thing to do is to work on your forest access road to make sure that you've got good wet weather usability. I put a number of references there that you've posted on the site for landowners, consideration to look at road design features that are going to improve usability during wet weather. Generally, that means things like addressing drainage, ditches, crossings, crowning road surfaces, putting surfacing on, graveling, that sort of thing.
Okay.
It's real important to invest wisely in your forest road system. Don't just go and put 6 inches of gravel over a whole mile of road. You need to focus the treatments where it will get you the most value.
Okay.
The final thing would be to market your tract then. If you've invested in that, make sure you're marketing your tract as a wet weather site so that you can get the value out of that.
All right, great. Thank you, Bob. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Dave Tenney, Jeff Helms, Chris Isaacson, and Cass Brewer. And we also appreciate the contributions of Becky Barlow, Gerald McGuinn, Michael Cunningham, and Bob Rummer. The AFOA is unashamed to promote private forest land. While some public land is desirable, how much is enough? Alabama has not 200,000 acres, not 500,000 acres, but 1.4 million acres of public forest land already. This burdens our state with a loss that can now be quantified. We suggest you obtain a copy of the study by the National Alliance of Forest Owners and draw your own conclusions. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.